Welcome back to the Physician Syndicate podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Greg.
And I am your other host, Ronak.
All right, so today we're going to talk about some more terms, some more angel investing terms that you should be aware of. And also, if you're going to go found a company, things you should be aware of when starting a company and when continuing to raise for that company. So where did this actually come from, this idea to talk about these further terms that we haven't even discussed yet on the show? I was reading a Twitter thread, which I will try to find again and put into the show notes, but there was a very active discussion from venture capitalists in the Bay Area about something called revesting, which, to be honest, I had never heard of before.
So when a company exists, it has what's called shares. Investors can go buy shares, employees can get shares as compensation. What is a share in a company? It basically is a small piece of ownership of the company where you have the rights to get some of the income that the company generates. And everything from a two-person startup to a giant company like American Express are going to have shares in the company. And as we'll get into on this episode, there are different type of shares, and there is a difference between being promised shares versus actually owning shares, having them in hand. So that being said, Greg, do you want to now go into what a cliff means?
Yeah. So one of those terms that you're going to first be introduced to when you're setting up your company is you're going to set up your vesting schedule. One of those first terms is the cliff. So what the cliff basically means as a founder of that company is, when do you start actually your vesting? When do you begin vesting your shares in that company? So that's what the cliff means, is basically you can think about it like you're falling off a cliff, right? So usually it's a 1 year cliff. You get to that 1 year anniversary mark of starting that company. Great. Now you're starting to vest. And so usually it's a 4 year vesting period. So that's the typical startup founder. Hey, you're going to be vesting 25% each year once you hit that 1 year mark, and you'll eventually have all your shares that you're owed for your founding the company, for the sweat equity that you're putting in within hopefully those first 4 years. The reason that we're talking about this is because for some founders, you might get to your 4 year anniversary mark before you go and raise something called a Series A. And so that's why this discussion came up on Twitter, was what do you do about founders that have fully vested their shares and they're trying to go raise a Series A of, let's say it's $20 million at a $100 million valuation, which is reasonable if you have $5 or $10 million in revenue and you need to raise $20 million from investors. The reason investors are interested in how long has your company been formed and how much vesting do you have left is because they're scared, they're worried that a founder that has already completely vested, has all of their shares in the company, could just leave the next day after they close their Series A. And guess what? You can't do anything about it. They have all of their shares already. So that's the reason that we're going to talk about this term revesting. So what does revesting mean? What it basically means is if that happens, right? So if you are a founder or your founding team has all vested completely and you're trying to go raise a Series A from, let's say you're raising from Andreessen Horowitz, great. You have $20 million term sheet, you're ready to go. In that term sheet though, it says you start over again. You revest, meaning you start from day one again, you have no shares in your company, and now they're asking you to revest over another 4 years. So those 4 years you did previously now basically mean nothing to you as the founder, even though you've now gotten it to a Series A raise and maybe you're starting to take an actual salary from it, but you go back to day one. Thoughts on that, Ronak?
This is a really rough situation for a founder of a company to have to go through a complete revest of your shares. So this also works with employees. So if you are ever thinking about joining a startup company, they might entice you with, call like a $50,000 salary, but then we'll give you $1 million worth of stock. Just like Greg described, that $1 million is going to follow a cliff in a vesting schedule, right? So you'll get an initial tranche after 1 year, and then maybe after every month or quarter, you get a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. But the nice thing about being an employee versus a founder is that you're not going to have to revest those shares. That if you go into some sort of negotiation with a new financing round, typically employees are taken care of, where once the shares are in hand, that employee doesn't really lose those shares. They can become devalued, and we'll get into that into just a second. But for the founders themselves to be building a company, let's say for the last 5 years, and then having a new investor come in and basically saying that you need to revest your shares, meaning you go back to zero. So technically, you don't own anything in the company in terms of ownership. And yes, you have the right to work for the next 4 years to regain your ownership standpoint. That hurts. And I think it's important for Greg, you and I, to really bring this point up, because whenever a startup company is going through a round of financing and negotiations like that, like this, it is a negotiation. If there is a founder that says that I don't want to go through this revesting schedule, you can say no to the investors and walk away from the VC deal. You don't have to take their money. You don't have to do this. The question in the balancing act that the entrepreneur really needs to play is the capital worth it to grow the company significantly faster, bigger, whatever it is, such that the shares that I will re-own in the future, soon to be, will be worth so much more so that I'm okay essentially giving up ownership of the company temporarily just to have to earn it back over the next few years.
Yeah, honestly, this seems pretty predatory to me. I don't think this was definitely not common in 2021, 2022, when it was a very founder-friendly market. And this is something that if I saw in a term sheet, if I ever got a company to a Series A or a Series B raise, I would not go with that investor, to be honest. Because basically what they're saying is, we don't trust you. We don't trust you are actually in this to grow this company over the next 10 years. We think you might bail. We think you might go to a big public company that's going to just give you $1 million salary contract when you think of RSUs and all of that. That seems like a complete cop-out. You've spent 4 or 5 years grinding and building a company, and maybe you bootstrapped it, and you're like, you literally get to this point where you have $10 or $20 million in revenue, and then you have a venture capital firm saying, nah, that doesn't count. Like, that's basically what it's saying. And it's like, you know what? If that's the case, I would much rather either not take that capital completely or go find somebody that is a lot more founder friendly than somebody that's going to be saying, hey, you have to revest. Like, I get it from the, honestly, I get it from the investor standpoint now that I'm turning into an investor, but I also don't think it's fair. As a founder also, if I had to revest after spending 4 or 5 years of potentially not taking any salary, not having any liquidation from the stocks, the shares that I own, I would basically give them the middle finger and say, you can go to hell. To be honest, that's how I feel about revesting.
I think that's right, Greg, but I would just remind you that this is a negotiation, right? If somebody is going to give you a $70 million valuation if you go through a revest versus the any other VC will just give you a $10 million valuation if you don't go through a revest, maybe it is worth thinking about. Like, it is a back and forth negotiation. There's a lot of different points at play during an equity price round of financing that you have to negotiate through. This is a big one that any founder should really look at closely and think through properly. I agree with you, Greg, that this is something that, like, most founders probably want to just give the middle finger to the investor and walk away from this deal. But I don't think it's fair to say that's going to be true 100% of the time. I think there are going to be moments where this is fair.
I'm trying to figure out if there's a correlation that we can think of for, like, how a VC might feel about this, right? So if it's, oh, hey, I'm going to take $1 million from you right now, and then in a year from now, I'm going to decide whether or not you earned the equity that you gave me with that $1 million. That's what it feels like. It's basically like you're trying to say, did you do your job as a VC? Like, I'm trying to turn the table and be like, this is what it would feel like.
So I do think that there are two classes of companies here, two classes of startups, right? So one is much more about the product, the service, the team that's being built, that if one day in a sad world, the CEO gets hit by a bus and is no longer part of, the company can still flourish, thrive. They can bring in somebody else from the outside world. They can hire from within and things are great. But you do also have a class of companies where the CEO is everything behind the company. And if the CEO disappears tomorrow, the entire company shuts down. You could think about if there's this genius CEO that, I don't know, built like a special type of laser that nobody else can even dream of, and you don't want to patent it or anything else because you don't want to explain it, right? That's the type of CEO that if that CEO disappears, whole company shuts down. What do you do? So you need to incentivize that CEO to stick around for longer, or if there's like a famous CEO, right? Like the value of the company is the brand name of the CEO. But then if the CEO leaves, then the entire value of the company disappears. So I do think that you need to balance out a little bit, like from the VC perspective, is this the type of company where the company absolutely needs to retain this one employee to continue being as successful as it is? Or to be honest, is the entrepreneur a little bit replaceable?
I think that's a good question, right? Is like, you need some kind of carrot to keep a person there if they fully vested. I don't think revesting is the necessary carrot that you have to use. I think you can come up with something that's a little more appropriate for a founder that's put in 5 years or 6 years of sweat equity. Or you go back to the beginning of the company and say, maybe we should change the average vesting period to something more like 6 years or 8 years, because then it at least avoids the risk of having to completely revest as a founder, which you mentioned, like getting hit by a bus. Imagine that situation. You are the founder of a company that's worth $100 million. Your entire net worth is within that company. And then you raise that Series A and they say you need to completely revest. Guess what? Your net worth goes back down to basically nothing because you don't own anything in that company anymore. You still have a cliff. You have to get to that cliff. You get hit by a bus and you have a family and you originally had those 100% shares that you had vested. No, realistically, like if that actually happens and they just replace you, your wife, your kids, that we're hoping, hey, that maybe that $100 million becomes $1 billion. And guess what? Now we have generational wealth. It disappears because you signed a term sheet that says you have to revest and you have another cliff to get through. But if you don't reach that cliff.
That's my point here, Greg, right? That if this CEO gets hit by a bus, the entire company is valueless now, right? So it doesn't even matter if like that founder's family has the shares or not. The entire company is worthless. It's that type of founder that you need to incentivize to stick around as long as possible.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but the founder has built something, right? The company still has the laser. Like, it's not like you don't have that laser once that founder gets hit by a bus. Like, it doesn't disappear with the founder. They have something that you can then go sell on the open market to somebody else, potentially, even without that founder being there. Like, the technology that's being built doesn't disappear because someone dies. It's not like your code repository just like blows up. That's not how it works, right? So I think there has to be some kind of balance between having a carrot that says, founder, we know that there is no incentive for you to stay anymore, but you have to create something other than revesting. I feel like that is completely unfair to the entrepreneur. And honestly, if you're an entrepreneur that is potentially staring down the barrel of a revesting, that's the only thing you have, I would figure out how to say F you to that venture capital firm and just go on continuing to bootstrap. Because guess what? Now you don't have to sell 20% of your company to them. And if you do go exit for $100 million, you got to keep all of that. Anyways, it's an interesting kind of term and it's an interesting, honestly, handcuff for somebody. We talk about golden handcuffs. Like when we sold our company to GoodRx, we got a vesting schedule for our RSUs. The problem is on their end, the stock tanked and there was no reason for me to financially stay anymore. I had a salary, yes, but the RSUs were almost completely worthless at that point. And it's what is my financial incentive for staying at the company? And there was no other carrot that they could really give me that would make me want to stay within that public company. So that's just another thing to think about. Revesting is definitely not a founder-friendly term within a term sheet. I would make sure that you're reading your term sheets when you're going through them, even if it's like a one or two page Series A term sheet. If you're a founder out there, make sure you have a really good lawyer that understands what all those terms actually means and make sure that you understand what those terms are and what they mean.
Greg, if we turn around for a second, if you're not the entrepreneur, but the angel investor, is this something that you would want to place on your entrepreneur?
If I'm making a bet on an entrepreneur, I'm placing that bet on them. I'm placing the bet that they want to build this company into a really large company. I'm not placing the bet that they're trying to raise capital and then bounce. If I even consider that as a possibility, I'm probably not going to invest in that company. If you think about we did a post-pitch podcast, if you want to go back and listen to it, the reason that I didn't invest in that company is because I didn't believe in the exit strategy. So if I don't believe that founder is in it to go and win a gigantic market and either IPO or worst case scenario, sell for a lot of money, I'm not going to invest in that company. So if I get any inkling that a founder is interested in leaving and going to sell secondary shares and then basically say, hey, I'm out. I've already vested all of my shares. I've sold a little bit of my common stock. Maybe they sold 20% in the Series A. I'm not going to invest.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. When you have a business, there are actually several different vehicles to have ownership stakes in the company. Three of the most common ones are going to be debt, common stock, and preferred stock. So let's just real quickly run through each one of those three. So debt is basically a loan, right? The company makes a loan to somebody. Let's say a company borrows $500,000 and they promise to pay it back in 3 years and they'll pay a 5% interest rate. Great. So that's not direct ownership in a company, but it is a way for an outside entity to get exposure to said company. And then the common stock and preferred stock. So this goes back to that whole idea of like when you buy a share of stock in a company or are given a share of stock, you're technically given a little bit of ownership of that company and have right to the income and distributions. The thing around common stock and preferred stock is there's all sorts of different terms around these two that make it way more complicated than meets the eye. Common stock is typically given out to employees who are working for the company. Preferred stock is typically given to investors that are putting in capital to the company to acquire shares. Now, when something happens to the company, let's say it goes through an acquisition, an IPO, some sort of exit happens, even if the company decides to declare bankruptcy and shuts down, the company will have some assets that it can liquidate. Or again, if it's going through an acquisition, it's going to get some money, some shares in some bigger company, whatever it is. The question is, how do those assets get distributed between the debt holders, the common stockholders, and the preferred stockholders? So there's what's called a waterfall. So basically, if there is a company that's, let's say, getting acquired, the first people that are going to get their money back is actually the debt holders. So if the debt holders get 100% of their money back, great. Now we can move over to the common stock and preferred stockholders getting some of their money back. But if there's not enough money that's being generated from the acquisition to fund the debt holders 100%, that means the common stockholders and the preferred stockholders are getting $0 back, even if a company is getting acquired for $100 million. So I think that's really important to look at when you're investing in a company, especially, does the company already have a significant amount of debt? Because if the answer is yes, then you coming in as a shareholder might actually be not all that valuable. Same thing if you're thinking about joining a startup as an employee. Do they already have too much debt that even with a quote unquote successful exit, you as a common stockholder will not do all that well?
Which brings up the topic of due diligence, right? So this is what you want to do as an investor is to actually see what does their cap table look like. So cap table is capitalization table. Who owns portions of the company? What is the instrument through which they own portions of that company? So that you can start to understand what Ronak's talking about in terms of, does the company have a bunch of venture debt that you're not aware of, but you maybe are aware of, hey, they raised a seed at $1.5 million of actual equity from a venture fund, but you're not realizing that, oh crap, they raised $5 million in venture debt. Like you want to know those things before you put the money into a startup.
So actually in a very extreme example, think about this. If a company is looking like that they're starting to fail and they're having trouble raising money through selling stock, if somebody comes and gives them just like a, let's say a $500 loan, and then the company defaults on that loan payment, for $500, you can basically buy the entire company and take 100% ownership of it. So that's why this due diligence that Greg's talking about is really important to really go and look at and understand what's going on behind the scenes. And if somebody wants to be really malicious and there's a, let's say, a horrible CEO out there that just wants to steal his company back from some investors that he brought on earlier on, he can basically himself personally give the company a loan, default it on purpose, and wipe out all the shareholders. That's a really bad thing to do. Very sharky. Lawsuits are going to happen left and right, but technically these are things to look out for.
And you'll probably never get an investment from anybody else in Silicon Valley.
That's right.
If you
That's
do
right.
something like that.
Right. So now when we look at, so if we put the debt side of things aside for a moment, the difference between common stock and preferred stock. So again, common stock is typically given to employees that are working to get shares in the company, and preferred stock is given to shareholders that are investing money into the company. Now,
and
when
founder stock, common stock.
That's right. That's right, Greg. That's right. Now, when preferred stock is being put together and given to shareholders, there usually is a little bit of negotiation behind it for what are the terms of that stock. And a common thing to ask for is what's called liquidation preference. So that again means that if a company is going through an exit, let's say the debt holders are taken care of 100%, no big deal. There still is a bunch of money left over. The preferred stockholders get paid next, and then the common stockholders do. So for those preferred stockholders, you can negotiate for a 1x liquidation preference, which basically means the investors need to at least be made whole. They get whatever money they put in back before the common stockholders start getting paid out as well. But you can also negotiate for a 2x liquidation preference, 3x liquidation preference, whatever you want. So basically, if a company has a 3x liquidation preference for their preferred stock, that means before any employee gets paid for their shares during an acquisition, the investors has to get at least three times their money back. So this again, once again, goes back to the due diligence side of things. That if you're thinking about joining a startup as an employee, do you actually know what type of upside you could potentially get? At the same time, if you're an investor, right? If you're taking a really big risk on a company and you have the ability to negotiate for liquidation preference or a higher level of liquidation preference, that's a huge thing, right? Not quite guaranteeing yourself a 2 or 3x multiple, but like skewing the odds largely in your favor like that. That again is something that founders have to think about. And if there is a VC fund or an investor that's pushing for a 3x liquidation preference, you really might want to say no to them, right? You're just limiting your upside as a founder. And if you have to raise capital, you have to raise capital. But these are the type of things that I think really founders should really take a pause and really think about, should they offer an investor liquidation preference of such high magnitudes or not?
Yeah, I will say that when we were trying to raise institutional capital for Flip, I think we got a term sheet that had 3x liquidation preference, which we ended up turning down for a couple reasons, one being the liquidation preference. And then the other, they wanted a 36-month warrant to keep the valuation of the company the exact same as it was when they had put their initial capital in, and then have the option to put additional capital at that same valuation for up to 3 years. So we ended up turning down basically for both reasons. They were unable to budge on those terms because it was honestly an East Coast VC that really just wanted to put in a little bit of sharky terms to make sure that their investment ended up paying out very nicely. I'm glad we didn't take that money. And for founders out there, you really want to look at the terms that you're giving people, especially early investors. As another side note, I was talking to a founder that took an angel investment, I think of $25,000, and gave away 5% of his company, basically valuing the company, I think, at $600K, something like that. So make sure you understand what you're actually giving away and how much that actually is going to convert to. Even if you're raising on a safe or something like that, you need to understand, what is this going to do to my cap table? What is this ultimately going to do if I'm able to actually have a liquidation event and exit my company? Just make sure your cap table is clean and you don't have anybody that owns like 10 or 20% for giving you like $10,000. That makes no sense. And honestly, then nobody's probably going to fund you in the future because somebody owns 20% of your company already. And if you do a seed round, that you take another 15 or 20 and then a series A to 15 or 20, you as a founder are going to own very little of your own company. Do your own little cap table hygiene and make sure that it's clean and that you're not taking really stupid deals.
So for the liquidation preference, I think the standard for the industry is 1x. And it would be very difficult for an entrepreneur to negotiate for less than that. And I think even as an investor, like I don't really see any good reason to push for anything lower. It's like you, as the investor, you're putting in money, you're trusting the entrepreneur, but at the same time, you do want a little bit of protection that they're not going to get paid out until you get paid out. Having a 2 or 3x liquidation preference, I do worry that's limiting the motivation for the entrepreneur. So if I were to participate in an equity round of financing, I really would want to stick somewhere around that 1x liquidation preference for both sides of the table.
Yeah. And when you think of why these terms come up, it's because the investors are trying to limit their basically downside. They want to make sure that if a company exits, they're going to get some kind of multiple. So you get it from like the investor standpoint, it's like trying to get a 2 or 3x liquidation preference. They're trying to return their fund. They're trying to go out and raise an additional fund. And now it's less of a founder-friendly market. So maybe they can get a 2 or 3x liquidation preference into some of these term sheets. And there's just maybe not that many other people that are interested in financing those companies. That's what it looks like right now. Again, like if you want to be that investor, go ahead. But you're not really going to get like a great reputation amongst founders if you're really pushing for some of the terms that are less founder friendly. Because again, you're not building the company. Yes, you are giving them investment. You're giving them capital to go and build the company even further. But you need to remember who's actually doing the work of building a company. It's not you. It's not you as the investor, even though there's a great Twitter handle if you guys want to follow it. I think it's called VC Brags. It literally just shows tweets about VCs taking credit for their portfolio companies, even though they had literally likely nothing to do with any of it. So just keep that in mind. As an angel investor, I have very little say in how things go. If a founder comes to me, sure, I'm going to give them my opinion, but it's the founder that's building the company. Just keep that in mind. And also, you as a investor, whether or not you're an angel investor or a venture capitalist at a venture fund, you're placing hopefully dozens or 20, 30, 40 different bets per fund. This founder has one bet that they're placing. It's their company, right? So you want to make sure that you're not screwing up with their cap table dynamics to the point that, hey, maybe they did go exit, but you took 3x liquidation preference and it limits the upside for that founder who put in their heart and soul into building that company. It's a raw deal in my mind.
Yeah, totally agree with that, Greg. I'm guessing in med school, they did not teach you about liquidation preference. So if there are any founders that are just struggling with some sort of some terms that are out there, feel free to reach out to myself or to Greg. We'd love to just chat through some of these different terms that are out there to make them a little bit more understandable and clear. So that way, any entrepreneur out there can be making the best decisions for themselves as possible.
Liquidation preferences are actually day two of orientation. I'm kidding. No, we weren't taught that in med school. All right, folks, that was the Physician Syndicate podcast episode on a couple different founder unfriendly terms that you should be aware of if you're starting a company. Hopefully you got something out of that episode. If you did, again, please share it with your friends. Give us a like and a following or rate us on Apple Podcasts. It's actually helpful. It gets us further up in the algorithm and allows other people to find our podcast. All right. Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. As always, we'd like to remind you that the information and opinions expressed on this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only and should not be construed as financial or investment advice. Before making any investment decisions, we strongly recommend that you consult with your lawyer, tax professional, and financial planner. Keep in mind that investing in startups can be extremely risky, and there's a potential for loss of your entire investment. Remember to always conduct thorough research and consider your risk tolerance before making any financial decisions. Stay informed, and we look forward to having you join us on our next episode of the Physician Syndicate podcast.